Just a few words about Lay Institute for Evangelism. I'm not going to keep you for any extended period of time, but I believe that this is a work that God has raised up for a specific purpose, and for that reason it may be helpful to share some of these things with you. The work began at a time when I was Director of Evangelism in the Anglican Diocese of Sydney. I had been invited to the World Congress on Evangelism in Berlin in 1966, and it seemed to me that what was really needed in evangelism today was not so much bigger calico signs, because I found that the more you advertised a mission, the more you warned off the fellow you really wanted. It was like saying to him, as you put your huge calico sign up, parish mission or something on, don't come this week, sport, they're spot on, they're after you. And you didn't get the person you were looking for, you got all the church members, and you could always tell when a church had had a mission because the faithful were very tired. And that was kind of the indication that they'd been more on the work, more involved with the work than normal, and I felt that the main thrust of evangelism must always be with the individual Christian. This was the way it was in the early church, and I'm sure that this is how it is meant to be in the church of today, that it is the average Christian that's meant to be gossiping the gospel rather than a special thing put on at the church. Sometimes we even use the normal services of the church as a means for evangelism, but I don't think this was meant either. I believe this is meant to be the faithful getting together in worship and inspiration, receiving a blessing in order that they might go out and bless and be the means of spreading the word to other people. But I looked back over my own ministry, and over many years I'd leaned across the pulpit and said to some of the nicest laymen, some of the best and most able, gifted executives, I'd said to them, "You ought to witness." And they'd look back at me in a kind of doleful, guilty way, like how? And I couldn't tell them. Because the kind of ministry that I exercised had so many Fletcherisms in it that I wouldn't want them to be called the nasty names that I was called, and I felt that there was no point in trying to make my layman the same as me. I had no ministry that I had practiced as being transferable. I'd never thought of transferring it to other people. And now I came to the conclusion that the most important factor in the Christian ministry is that one layman should be able to share sensibly and comfortably with somebody else. But how? And so on the way to and from Berlin, I looked for ways in which laymen can share. I remember spending an hour with the Director of Evangelism for the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod as we were in a comfortable setting together for an hour in Washington, D.C., and he told me of all the strategies that he brought out in his book, which was what got me in touch with him. He had a strategy for evangelism. And I said, "That's great, Charles. You've got the layman to the front door. You've cased the district. You've found out where the need is. You've got everything worked out. And at last, the layman's arrived at the front door. Now, what does he say?" He said, "That's what we're getting on to next." I said, "Well, when you've got on to that, brother, you let me know, because that's exactly where I'm at. That's what I want to know. What does the layman say when he gets there?" Then I discovered that there were some groups who had been thinking along this line, and I went to the first Pastor's Institute for Evangelism in San Bernardino at Campus Crusade for Christ headquarters. I spoiled a beautiful itinerary that had been carefully worked over for months in order to get back to this particular pastor's institute. And there were about 400 clergy from all different denominations, some I'd heard of and some I didn't know existed. But they were all there, and we shared together over the course of about 5 or 6 days concepts on how a lay ministry can be organised and made effective. And I was excited about it. And I came back, and as a sideline to the ministry that I was exercising as director of evangelism, I began to show laymen how they could share their faith. A number of parish missions I turned into training sessions, and instead of getting the church people to try and get people to come and hear me, I trained laymen to go out and share in their parish situation. And we saw some life-changing phenomena at that time. We saw people who had been just pew propers, sitting up in church every Sunday, coming alive. We saw people who couldn't believe that it was possible for them being involved. I remember one man who was the major executive of a very big organisation in Sydney, and when his pastor told him that he ought to go to this, he said, "You'd have to be joking." He said, "Any executive who can set aside 5 nights in a week, man, he just isn't in business. There's no man who can make that kind of time available, and I'm sorry." 3 months later, I met this fellow, signed up for an institute. And I said, "Hey, whatever happened to you, Ed, that you came here? I thought no executive worth his while could possibly get 5 nights in a row." He said, "Couldn't have come at a worse time." He said, "I've got to go overseas for 3 months on Tuesday." And he said, but here I am, lined up. He said, "Because if it's as good as my brother reckons it is," he said, "I'm in for it." And that man was in for a life-changing experience. He was a keen Christian, but he was a man who'd never really been able to share his faith. During the course of the training of that week that went over 5 nights, it began on the Monday and it was the Tuesday week that he had to go overseas for 3 months. And he was there every night for 5 nights. About Tuesday night, when he learned what it was to be filled with the Spirit of God and under the control of the Spirit of God, that man began to realise that he was meant to be involved. Wednesday, he went to work and he called in his foreman from the factory, and he said, "Listen, Ed," he said, "have I ever shared my faith with you?" He said, "You what, sir?" He said, "Have I ever talked to you about my faith in Christ?" He said, "Well, sir," he said, "I knew you went to church, but no, I don't think we've ever talked much about this." Well, he said, "Sit down, I want to talk to you." And he took this fellow through the four spiritual laws. Well, when they got to the two circles, he said, "Which circle do you reckon you are, Ed?" He said, "Oh, I'm the left one, sir." He said, "Which would you like to be?" He said, "I'd like to be the right one. With any reason why you wouldn't like to pray this prayer right now?" "No, there's none at all." And they went right through, and this fella prayed the prayer. At the end of it, he said, "Well, now, sir," he said, "you've taken a good bit of your time expressing this to me. Do you mind if I take a little bit more time and use your phone?" He said, "No." He said, "No, it's quite okay. Any problem?" He said, "No." He said, "I'd like to ring home." He said, "You got trouble at home?" He said, "No, I think it might be the end of trouble at home." He said, "As a matter of fact," he said, "my wife's been on me for years to do something about this, and I just wasn't too sure how it'd fit in with business, but you've answered that for me this morning. I'd like to just let her know, and I think it might be a nice little happy home we'll have from here on." And do you know, that was the change, not only of that business executive, but of his foreman. It was a complete change in his life. I was reminded just the other day by David that of an instance we had in a Presbyterian church here in Manly, where the minister's daughter, after the first night of training, she got the idea that maybe this little book would be a help to her. She was on a special assignment in the hospital with a case of a woman who was very ill and not expected to live. During the course of that night, she'd just had training from 7 till 9. That Monday night, she was at hospital, and this woman called for her and said, "Dear," she said, "I'm slipping and I'm not ready to go." She said, "Could you help me?" And this girl thought, goodness me, you know, is this time for aspirin, morphia, or what do you do? And she recognized it was a spiritual need, and so she took the little book and she read to this woman, and as she got to the prayer, she said, if you want to pray this prayer, just nod your head. And she nodded her head and she said, right, I'll read it phrase by phrase and you just follow after me. And so she went through that prayer. Now you might say, goodness me, you know, you couldn't really call that a great conversion experience, couldn't you? That nurse found that the woman was peaceful at last. And she went off duty. Next night when she came back on duty, she found a letter waiting for her, a letter that she treasures. I asked her, could I have it? But she wouldn't let me have it because it's too precious to her. She had this letter, and it was written by one of the nurses at the dictation of this woman. She said, nurse, I didn't have time to say thank you to you before you went off duty, but I want you to know that I am at peace because he is on the throne of my life. Now, where did she pick that phrase up from? That was in the prayer that I read to you last night out of the four spiritual laws. And that woman had recognized that she was at peace and that Christ was on the throne of her life. So could she go and check up with her? No, the woman was gone. She'd gone to be with the Lord. And that nurse recognized that even though she was only one night in the midst of five nights of training, God had used her in that first night to allow someone to pass from this scene in peace rather than in the turmoil and uncertainty and the doom of a person who didn't know Christ. And so we recognise that it can be very important to have a simple way whereby other people can share their faith. Now, I began training people in this way, and eventually I began to get invitations to other denominations, tut tut, and to other dioceses, which is, you know, and it was awkward. I was all the time asking the Archbishop permission to go here and go there, and eventually I had to admit to him that the baby had become a monster. Did he want me to kiss it goodbye or go with it? Well, you could guess what he would say, you know, at last. No, really, he said to me, look, I feel that this is a very important ministry. I feel it would lose its effectiveness if it was apart from the church. And I think that you ought to keep your hand on it, but keep your links with the diocese. And so I remained a clergyman in the Diocese of Sydney, licensed by the Archbishop of Sydney, but the head of a new organisation that we formed called Lay Institute for Evangelism. Now, since then, God has given us staff. I find it very easy to add staff. I was in New Zealand, and a fellow rang me up. Now, he was the managing director of a subsidiary of a data card company here in Sydney, in Australia. And this fellow said to me, Jeff, can I join staff? I said, well, Bill, you're already an associate staff member. What do you want to do more about? He said, I want to be full-time. I said, well, there's one difference, man. If you're going to be full-time, you raise your own support. Now, of course, when you've got to raise your own support, I can afford to put them on. No problem to me. I can add staff like crazy if they raise their own support. Matter of fact, this is the answer for the unions, if they only realised it. You know, the other day, the wages went up. And I announced to the staff that we work on the basis of the minimum clergy stipend for the Diocese of Sydney, because I have access to the information, and it means that there's an independent committee working on what is the minimum wage clergy should get, and all my top executives work at that basis. Now, the other day I announced to them that the Stipends and Allowances Committee had met and they'd decided that there had to be an increase. And I said, well, fellas, there's an increase. And with one accord, they moaned and said, oh, no. I said, why, what's up, fellas? I said, we've got to raise more support. Now, if only we could get the unions to take on this where they raised their own support, instead of clamoring for higher wages, they'd groan every time there was a now, don't you reckon Bob Hawke ought to take this on? I mean, there's a wonderful scheme, but I just can't sell it to them. But here are fellas. Now, Bill, in his first year, his income was less than he paid in tax the year before. But he's as happy as a lark. We're doing very nicely, thank you very much. Because I don't believe that the best living is done by the people with the top incomes today. I think they're the people with the most problems. And I think that the person with a lower income, if you can live at that level, they're on a much better deal. Now, don't let that be known, or they'll all want to be on the lower incomes, but I believe that there's something in this, that the fellow with the big income, he's got real problems, and the government's not helping very often. You know, they got to get him to make in one of those horrible returns, and he finds he's been lashed from every level. God has given us 18 members of staff, and they're top executives. The assistant manager of the Universal Guarantee Corporation come and ask, and these aren't old fellas that are retired. Bill's 35, Enoch's about 40. These are fellas that at the prime of life, but they're men who have been sitting up in a pew reckoning that was life in the church, listening, sitting, soaking and souring half the time, but God suddenly showed them that they were meant to be involved, and involved at a level that was meaningful as far as other people were concerned. And so we found we had an organisation on our hands. I determined right from the start that we wouldn't set up boards and committees and councils, because I'd been 20 years working with the church, and I discovered in the church that we've got a good way of killing any vision. Well, I don't know about your church. Yours is probably one of those wonderful churches. But I find that in the Anglican church, if anybody gets a vision, some young blood, you know, gets an idea, what we do is we refer it to a committee, and we make sure that we have on that committee three dead old archdeacons and possibly a bishop if it's an important matter, and then we'll get a couple of lawyers who'll find a reason why the Constitution won't allow it, and then two accountants who'll say that it's not financially viable. And so the poor young bloke dies under all this great heap of things that he's... Of course, the first meeting, they kill it. What they do, they sit down and they have a look at the problems involved. And after they get five fool's cap sheets of problems that would be involved with this mad youngster's vision, need you go any further? That's finished that. Thank you. We'll file that in Commission Report 2A little B, subsection C, and it's gone. Well, I determined we wouldn't have that. We'd have an organisation run by staff. I reserve the right to veto any decisions on the basis of experience, but I've never had to veto any visions or veto any decisions, because I believe that when you are working together in unanimity, and I believe this is how we're meant to work in the church, I believe that every decision should not be a majority decision, but a unanimous decision. I believe we ought to be agreed in the Holy Spirit on matters that we're going forward on. And if there are things in which there's a strong difference, then we ought to go to prayer about it and make sure that we're all in the condition, spiritually, where the Spirit of God can minister to us and solve this difference. And if we can't come to an agreement there, we ought to shelve it until we can come to an agreement. I'm all for unanimous decisions in matters where the Spirit of God is leading us. I think that we only create division where we vote, and you know, there are five of us by careful lobbying and only four of them, and so we've got them fixed. As a matter of fact, it was just lucky that I got Jack in on the committee last time, or we'd have lost this vote. I don't think that's how it's meant to be. And so we've got an organisation with a minimum of administration, very careful on the financial side. You can ask any time to have a look at our at our financial statement and you'll find that it's audited and well up to date. Nobody has access to funds. It's all on the basis of it being organised, and you organise your own support, so you can only draw from your own support. Now, what are the aims of this organisation? We believe that a great commission has been given to the church to reach every person, and we see our responsibility in Australia as the reaching of every person in this country with a meaningful presentation of the gospel. We don't believe we're meant to do it. As a matter of fact, we try and organise to make sure that nobody thinks that we're meant to do it. We're not looking for a big staff. We're looking for a minimum staff that can initiate movement in the church. We believe that the Great Commission was given to the church, and only the church is meant to fulfil it. And our work is to stimulate and to train to initiate in the church something that the church will do. And when the church gets moving, we're going to disappear overnight and become part of the church that's doing it. You won't see us anymore. We'll just be there with the church that we've been worshipping with. We'll be in the job getting it. But we've got to get the church seeing this and moving to it. The average church doesn't see their role as reaching the people of their community. I was talking to a Presbyterian minister one day in another country, and I said to him, Tom, what's the goal and objective of your church? Oh, he said, that's easy. I've just preached a 7-point sermon on it. I said, oh, great, I might have some new material that I can use myself from this point on. Let's have it. Well, he said, I see the goal of our church as a church with an increasing concern for evangelism. Oh, I said, Tom, that's lovely. But what is it? A growing concern for evangelism. That's not a goal. That's a sentiment. What does it look like? What's the halfway mark to a growing concern for evangelism? A half-growing concern, or a growing half-concern, or a growing concern for a half-evangelism? What are you talking about? That's not a goal. That's a feeling. It's a nice thought you've had. What's the second one? A church with an increasing missionary outreach. Well, I said, look, ma'am, whatever you put in that ing, you're in trouble, because you're talking about a sentiment. What do you mean by an increasing missionary outreach? Do you want your furthest out missionary to sell her home and buy one a mile away? Or do you want one more person involved in the missionary program of your church? What are you talking about? He said, I don't think I'd better give you the rest. I said, well, you better give them to me, because we might be able to make something out. He said, an increasing missionary budget. I said, now budget, now man, you're onto something. We could give you a halfway mark to that one, but how much do you want it to increase? By $1 a year, or one more person giving? What are you talking about? Let's think in specific terms. And we helped that church just by applying some management principles to really get to grips with what is their role. And do you know that that church has accepted their responsibility, because Tom turned around to me and said, all right, what do you reckon we ought to do? Well, I said, look, Tom, what do you reckon is a reasonable responsibility for your church? Here you are in a situation, they had the sea on one side, they had a river coming down here, they had a railway line that went across there, and it beautifully outlined a parish. Now I said, Tom, would you reckon that's your area of responsibility? There you are, by the grace of God, the divine overruling providence of God, if you're a good Calvinist, there you are, right in the middle of that area. Now, do you reckon that that's your area of responsibility? Oh, he said, it well could be. I said, well, now how many people are in that area? Oh, he said, about 10,000, I suppose. Right, I said, what's your program for reaching them? When do you aim to reach them? Well, he said, the church has been here about 80 years to this point, and I don't think they've reached them yet. I said, man, if you want another 80 years, you better get a very young understudy, because you're not going to make it. Well, he said, what do you reckon might be reasonable? I said, well, let's work on 5 years. Oh, he said, I don't think you could do it in 5 years. I said, look, Tom, let's be reasonable. There was a census taken in this area 2 months ago. Did they take 5 years to take it? He said, oh, no, it was all over within a month. And I said, did they reach every home? He said, yeah. I said, how long would they spend in each home? Oh, he said, about an hour. I said, well, somehow they did it. How did they do it? He said, oh, they got a lot of people involved. I said, you mean you better get a lot of people involved. Think in terms of a target. 5 years. 2,000 a year. How many people could you get involved? Oh, he said, I don't know. He said, I've got a fairly good nucleus. I said, look, could you think in terms of a number of people giving one night a week and Sunday afternoon? For 40 weeks of the year, give them 12 weeks in which they've got to do nothing. For 40 weeks of the year, they're giving one night and Sunday afternoon, 4 hours a week. Could you find people who could do that? And we worked out that if he had 25 people working 4 hours a week for 40 weeks out of 52 in the year, without using any of the ones that they won, and bear in mind that the new people you win are the most energetic and the most enthusiastic, so that he'd have done it in much less time, but if he'd only used that initial team of 25 for 4 hours a week, for 40 weeks of the year, he'd have reached his whole area of responsibility in 5 years. Do you know that was 3 years ago? And they've reached 75% of their area of responsibility. Why? Well, just because there was sown in their idea, in their mind, an idea that was scriptural. They began to see that they had a responsibility. As Archbishop Temple said, the church is the one organisation that exists solely for the benefit of non-members. We meet together to inspire one another to learn from the scriptures in order to go out and reach the people who are not reached. And when he saw that, he began on an active program of evangelism. Now, when we first started up, we thought our job was to just train everything that moves. And we ran citywide lay institutes in Sydney, in St Andrew's Cathedral. We had 1,500 people in the 1 week. We had people coming and going like it was for real. We had people everywhere. And we trained 1,500 people in that 1 week in St Andrew's Cathedral. Where are they today? I don't know. I meet people every now and again. Oh, I was at that cathedral institute and I've been sharing every now and again since. But you see, what we recognised was that people are not meant to function. As we see it, is to see that the pastor wants to be involved. If he doesn't, no go. We will not be involved unless the person who has the leadership, we recognise authority in the chain of command. And whoever's in charge of that worshipping group, whoever the leadership are, whether it's elders or whoever it is, whoever the leadership are, unless they see it, we won't be part of it. So we run clergy management courses. Now this isn't to make the clergy, you know, good administrators necessarily. It's to teach them that management is getting work done through others. And we're not going to try and clutter them up with a whole lot of administration. We're going to show them simple principles used in business everywhere. How to plan, to organise, to lead, to control, to delegate, and to supervise. How to get other people involved so that they can get time to be the coach of a team that's working to reach their area of responsibility. Now, once we get the pastor recognising not only the task, but the management principles involved, then he begins to cotton on a bit. He recognises that this is not going to override his opportunity to minister in the word and the sacraments, that this is going to mean that he's got more time. And so then when he gets excited, we say, well, now cool down, fella. Come along with the leadership of your church. Come along with your church wardens or your deacons or your elders or whoever the leadership of your church. Come to a conference-style weekend. and have a look at what we're saying. And if they come away with their pastor and they agree with their pastor that this is something they ought to do, we say, all right, now bring one more level of leadership. You come back again and do strategies in order to be able to train others in your own church. You are now to be the training cadre. You come back, but bring some others, the next level of leadership, to do the introductory so that you've got within that church a convinced group. So you won't have a new idea introduced that everybody's again. You know, evangelism can split a church as quick as anything. We do it. We don't. You aren't spiritual. Not doing it. And you're mean and horrible the way you do it. And so you've got a real split down the middle of the church on evangelism. You wouldn't believe it, would you? You can do this with a prayer meeting. We go to the prayer meeting. We don't. And we can split over anything. And evangelism can split a church very readily if it's put in as something that must be done. So we won't do this. And unless the church is convinced that this is what they ought to do, we won't be part of it. But when the church recognises through its leadership that this is what they ought to do, then we go and we conduct a training program in that church. Afterwards, there's an ongoing program, a 12-week training program of evangelism training, in which we try and get a group who have a strategy that is appropriate to that church. We think through the program as we think of a church, what is the best outside warm contact that this church has? I know an Anglican church in Sydney, and they have 170 baptisms a year. You say, wouldn't be by immersion, I suppose they're all kids. Look, I'm not arguing about what kind of baptism. All I'm saying is that in this church, they have 170 people who come to them and say, we want our baby baptised. Well, we say, well, listen, mate, don't rock it and don't knock it. That's a good outside contact. Just make sure you're making a good contact. So we trained for them 12 people who can deal with the parents of children that have been baptised. And that's the strategy initially for that church. A good outreach strategy. Another one, we had a Baptist church where they had a very good boys brigade. And we said, beauty, let's get to the parents of the young fellas in the boys brigade. And we trained people how to go to a home, how to meet up with the parents, how to get to spiritual matters, how to encourage those parents to be involved in an outreach program in a home before we tried to usher them into the Holy of Holies in the church. And so a strategy is worked out and a group are trained in that strategy. Then we have a discipleship training program for another 16 weeks, 12 to 16 weeks, in which we train them to help those that they've led to Christ. And then they can go on another period of training in leadership training, in which we're training leaders to carry on the program without any help from an outside organisation. Our aim is to have churches that have an ongoing training program in their own church that can carry out their own evangelism. They don't have to call in an outside wonder worker. That can be a good strategy at times as a special. But there ought to be a continuing evangelism program going on in that church. And that's what we're aiming at. Now, because we're a self-destruct organisation, we've got no buildings, we own nothing, we can fold up overnight, and they can say, Lay Institute, I used to hear that once. Where have they gone? And it ought to be that nobody knows. They were here, but they disappeared. Maybe that's why the lay coordinator is called Enoch. You know, he was not, for God took him. And maybe that's what's going to happen with the whole organisation, that there'll come a time when we'll just disappear because the church has seen clearly her job and has got on with it, and there's no need any longer for such an organisation to exist. Pray for your church Pray for your pastor. Pray that you will be seeing clearly what you're meant to be, a worshipping group of people, the means by which the life and love and the power and the forgiveness of God is made manifest in the world. And as you pray about it, you'll find God will have you involved.